You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Academy.
It is a pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Lynn Parker today and join her on this, you know, figurative stage. Dr. Parker is a pioneer in AI policy, and she played an integral role in numerous landmark national AI policies, including the first AI R&D strategic plan at the end of the Obama administration, and the Select Committee on AI, and the updated AI R&D strategic plan, and now is the founding director of the National AI Initiative Office and the co-chair of the National AI Research Resource Task Force. Dr. Parker also serves as the Assistant Director of Artificial Intelligence at the White House OSTP, where she's been since 2018. She's on assignment from UT Knoxville, where she's a professor of computer science and a former interim dean of engineering. She's served as National Science Foundation's Division Director for Information and Intelligence Systems and as a distinguished research and development staff member at Oak Ridge. She earned National Laboratory. She earned a PhD from MIT and is a fellow of IEEE, fellow of AAAS, and a distinguished member of the Association for Computing Machinery. Now, Lynn, we know you've had the monumental task of what is pretty much coordinating and expanding AI R&D across the entire federal government, so we very much appreciate you taking the time.
Great. Thanks so much, Austin.
Now, and before we get started, I want to plug the great work you've done on AI.gov. If you guys haven't checked it out, it's a great resource for pretty much all AI policy. It has the subdivisions of, like, you know, the NAIR task force we're about to talk about and all the other, like, I mean, God, how many different things are you managing there? Like 12 different distinct operations? But it's really great, and it has all of the notes and the meeting minutes and videos and presentations and stuff. Really recommend you check it out. But we're here to talk about the NAIR task force. Lynn, can you give us a little bit of background and how it plays into the broader AI initiative that you're, you know, running right now?
Yeah, sure thing. So, you know, as this audience is aware, AI does hold the potential to be an engine of innovation, and it impacts almost everything from science to the economy to national security and society itself. But there's also been a recognition that access to the computational and data resources that are fueling much of that innovation in AI is primarily limited to large private sector firms and well-resourced universities. So that's created a divide in terms of opportunity. Additionally, you know, traditionally underserved communities lack sufficient representation and pathways to participation in AI innovation. So this can create some opportunities, negative opportunities for bias in AI tools and approaches and so forth. So the idea is to expand access to these kinds of resources will broaden the diversity of researchers involved in AI and expand approaches to and the applications of AI. And so with that increased access and diversity of perspectives, it could lead to new bright ideas that would not otherwise materialize or be developed. So additionally, expanding access would strengthen our national ability to build AI that's more equitable and meets the needs of all the Americans. So a complementary type of investment is also to create an innovative and diverse AI workforce through both training and career and professional development. So with all of that context in mind, Congress then directed the formation of the National AI Research Resource Task Force. We call it NAIR for short, the NAIR Task Force. And that was directed as part of the National AI Initiative Act of 2020. That in turn became law in January of this year. And so this task force is mandated with producing a roadmap and an implementation plan for creating a national AI research resource. If it's implemented, then the NAIR would democratize access to the computing and data infrastructure needed for our nation's AI researchers. And it also provides an important opportunity for students to engage in AI R&D. And so this would then allow us to include communities and institutions and regions that have been traditionally underserved. So that's kind of at a super high level what the motivation is for creating a NAIR. Let me just take a couple of minutes and situate this within the larger context of the National AI Initiative. So the National AI Initiative Act of 2020 was much broader than specifically this task force. And that National AI Initiative has three main goals, or really kind of four main goals. One is to ensure that the U.S. continues to lead the world in AI research and development. A second is to ensure that the U.S. leads the world in the development and use of trustworthy AI in both the public and private sectors. Third is to prepare the present and future U.S. workforce for integration of AI systems across all sectors of the economy and society. And then the fourth area is really to coordinate all of these efforts across the federal government and with partners who are contributing to the initiative in the private sector and academia, civil society, and so forth. Now, this legislation also created the National AI Initiative Office, which I lead. So that coordination activity happens within the National AI Initiative Office. And thanks, Austin, for plugging the AI.gov. That really lays out a lot of the activities that the National AI Initiative is involved in. So let me very quickly give you a summary of what those the categories of activities that the broader National AI Initiative is working on. So first is AI research and development. And our priority in that area is to have sustained investments in our national AI innovation ecosystem. We want to make sure that cutting edge breakthroughs in AI are continuing to occur in the United States. And of course, that they are aligned with our values. The second is AI research infrastructure. And so in that area, we're focused on efforts that broaden access to cutting edge computational resources and high quality data sets to advance AI research. Also to support equitable growth, expand AI expertise, and enable application to a broader range of fields. So what we're talking about today is exactly in this category, this pillar of activity. It's the work of the National AI Research Resource is very much about expanding access to AI infrastructure. A third pillar of activity for the National AI Initiative is the development of trustworthy AI. And so that involves research, of course, but it also involves the development of technical standards, risk management frameworks, and guidance and governance that protects privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. A fourth pillar of activity in the National AI Initiative is in education and workforce. And so, as I've already mentioned, we must fill the AI talent gap and prepare U.S. workers for the jobs of today and the jobs of the future. And that involves implementing policies that ensure a diverse, inclusive, and knowledgeable workforce. A fifth area of activity for the National AI Initiative is international engagement. We need to and are working with like-minded allies to advance the development and use of AI in line with our shared democratic values. This is happening in multiple agencies through multiple venues, including the Global Partnership on AI, as well as the work of the AI Expert Group at the OECD. And then finally, the sixth pillar of activity of the National AI Initiative is in the use of AI within the federal government. And so we want to promote the innovation and use of AI within the federal government, but to do that in an appropriate way. It can improve operations across the government. It can provide better services for the people of the nation. It can improve national security and so forth. And so we want to do this in a way that's consistent with established principles and ethics frameworks and so forth. So all of these six pillars of activity are important and are the areas that are being emphasized for the National AI Initiative. So what we're talking about today with the National AI Research Resource is specific to the AI infrastructure pillar of that initiative.
No, that makes sense. And actually, I would say for anybody who wants to look at this and break it down a little bit, not to overplug AI.gov, but if you go to the task force subpage, you can see in their last meeting, a couple weeks ago, you can not only see Lynn's slide that breaks all six of these down and kind of what's in them, you can also see how the task force, they're thinking about this subdivided by value proposition and all that. It's really helpful. But I've noticed if you look at the RFI that you guys have out there, which we'll get to that, and just the conversations around it, there are a lot of fundamental questions you're grappling with, right? Like the breadth and depth of this thing could be anything. And I mean, to your point, it's an unbelievably important enterprise and kind of a cornerstone of a lot of the other things that we would want to do, I think. Not to make a completely solid statement there, but it seems to be the case. So could you maybe lay out some of the fundamental questions you're grappling with?
Yeah, there's a lot. This is not an easy task at all. The vision for this, the implementation plan for how to actually create this create the NAIR is requiring us to address a lot of things. So number one is how do we measure success? I think knowing how we measure success really drives how we create the implementation plan. And so what's the impact? And so that's, I think, fundamental to how we how we get started. Another key question is who should have access to the resource? You know, which AI researchers, which students? Should it also include startup companies, for instance? So that's another question. Another question is just what should be in the NAIR? What capabilities should be there? It's not going to be all new. We're talking about stitching together a lot of existing resources in a federated sense, but which resources? It could be cloud-based computing, commercial cloud, or it could be high-performance computing that may be on-premise at a particular university, for instance. It could be novel computing architectures like neuromorphic computing or quantum computing. It could include data sets, access to data, software tools, test beds, and other types of testing. It could include educational resources and other ways to collaborate. So that's another huge bucket of fundamental questions we have to address. We have to figure out how do we adjudicate access? There, however much resource is there, it will still be less than what's needed. The supply will always be less than the demand. So how do we allocate those resources to a diverse group of users and do it equitably? How do we make sure that we can add new resources, that we can refresh the resources over time? How do we fund it? How do we manage it? How do we address concerns about ethical and responsible development of AI, say through the kinds of data sets that are being made available? So these are just some of the tough questions that the task force is working on. And I'm sure we could go all day and list a number of other questions, but that's some of the fundamental ones.
Yeah, and I think the definition of measuring success, I feel like that is a great one to hit up front because, I mean, realistically, it could go as far as you want, right? Like there was commentary in the last one about how, you know, if there's cost constraints and we're obviously going to hit those, right? But, you know, we have the geopolitical concern, we have the social concerns. Anyways, so how should, you know, legislators and other folks engage in the process? I know there's at least one RFI out, maybe you can speak to that or any other advice.
Yeah, absolutely. So in mid-July, OSTP and the National Science Foundation, and by the way, we're the ones that co-chair the task force, NSF and OSTP. So we together issued an RFI or a request for information that's on the Federal Register. And we very much want to gather everybody's input on the implementation, on all these fundamental questions that I mentioned and some others that are mentioned in the RFI. And so it's open for comments until October 1st. Originally it was September 1st, but that wasn't enough time and it was summertime. So we extended it to October 1st. And that's a great way for all the experts out there and the people that have opinions about how to shape this NAIR. That's a great way for people to provide that sort of input. And like I say, the RFI asks about all these different questions that I've already noted. And it also suggests that if you have comments on what building blocks for the NAIR already exist, what can we leverage that's already out there? What about public-private partnerships? You know, what's the role of industry in creating the NAIR, for instance? And so any and all input to that RFI would be greatly appreciated. And then that input will go directly into the work of the task force. And so that will be extremely valuable.
Okay, thank you. And I'll say for people that haven't looked at the RFI, it is the depth of the number of fundamental questions is pretty overwhelming. But just, I would say, you know, respond to whatever you can, right? I mean, I think Lynn would agree with that, but just whatever input gets in to help refine this process, I think will be really constructive. So do you think the next round, like, sorry, it's kind of off the cuff, but do you think that what's going to happen is we'll have this RFI and it'll scope in a little bit, and then you'll kind of try to work within that scope in a little bit? I mean, I'm assuming you're going to have to do the scoping questions first and then dig in. Or do you just say that's kind of evolved over time?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the gist of how we're working on the task force right now, and it can always evolve, but we've had two meetings, and we're also doing some working groups right now to dig into some of the areas more generally. But what we're trying to do is over time hone in on some answers to some of the key questions as we, each of the key questions as we go. And so I think, you know, like right now we're focusing on questions of kind of what's the vision for the NAIR, who should have access, who are the particular users, and some of those, you know, what is the value proposition here? What is it that we want to achieve at the end? How do we know that we've done something worthwhile at the end and had an impact? So we're trying to scope out those really fundamental, the most fundamental of the fundamental questions right up front. And so my thinking right now is that once we release the interim report, which will be in May, then we may also do another RFI at that point to get people to comment on the interim report so that then we can have time to adjust that as needed before the final report is due in November. So we're trying our best to make decisions along the way so that a lot of these questions are dependent on each other. And so pinning down some answers on some questions will help us with some of the future ones.
That makes sense. And you sprung another question to mind. You know, I think a lot of people loved how at the NSCAI report that they had legislative text at the end, right? Do you anticipate that's something that the NAIR task force will do?
Well,
feel free to defer.
I think that's always an open possibility. It's true that the recommendations from the National Security Commission on AI, by having legislation included as part of the report, it makes it easier to translate ideas into concrete next steps, obviously through legislation. So I think we're certainly open to that. We'll see how the task force goes. But it's a possibility. I'll just say it's a possibility.
Okay, great. I mean, that's encouraging. So I guess taking a step back to like the broader topic. So, how do you think that the work of the task force is going to tie together with the concerns about U.S. competitiveness and inclusion in workforce development? Like, I know you kind of laid out that those are components of it, but, you know, how do you anticipate that plays out if you have something?
Yeah, so it's certainly true that strategically, the objective of the NAIR is to strengthen our U.S. innovation ecosystem and to do it by making it easier for so many more people to engage in AI research. And then this can have an implication as well for particular use cases. So you can also advance use-inspired research as well. But there also is a ripple effect here in that if you expand access to the resources that are needed to do this research, then you're also expanding the opportunities for more students to get involved or just people in general, professionals of different sorts. And by having more people, a diverse array of people who now have access to the resources that are needed to do the research, you're building up the workforce at the same time. And so now it is a ripple effect in that as you build up more capability within sort of the human capital, now there's the opportunity, say, for spinoff companies that come out from the research that individuals do. And so those spinoff companies then can increase innovation and increase competitiveness by creating new products and services that are taking advantage of the insights that were gained from the research. So I think there is this kind of positive feedback loop that happens here by providing the access to the resources. You can do more research, you can educate more people, train more people, and then they have better, great ideas, and then that can spin off into more innovation that is ready for the marketplace or new services and so forth. So that's a really important aspect of thinking about the NAIR. It's much more than just here's a computational and data resource.
No, that makes sense to me. And I'll say, I mean, I think it's, it's kind of like capitalizing on our special power as America, right? Like we have this incredible diverse body of people spread all across diverse, type of landscapes and industries. And I think we've only empowered some of them. Of course, this is like a fundamental concept of it, but I'm just excited to see what people's different experiences yield, like what kind of things we wouldn't possibly imagine that will happen because we've never experienced the things that whoever it is does. not to overly comment. Anyways, so I'm, you know, along those lines, I heard commentary during the last task force meeting in the value proposition panel, kind of a foundational panel to the meeting, about the importance of physical locations and the community impact of building some type of resource, you know, trying to make sure that this brings something back home, that this provides opportunity, not just to whoever can kind of like fly off to the tower, but for all of us. And I think that, you know, that is a critical aspect of either this or a combination of this and other things. So how much do you anticipate that, you know, that type of local activity plays into the Nair? Of course, there's anchoring at some universities perhaps, but what else do you see happening and to what extent, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the diversity of opportunities for people to access is critical in that you can think about lots of different communities of people who have not been engaging in these areas. So you mentioned that panel and that panel on the value proposition at the most recent NAIR task force meeting. It included some experts from HBCUs and also from EBSCoR states. And it's kind of related to the point I was making a moment ago. I think by having people from a variety of different communities that historically have not been involved in these areas, then sort of in a lot of different geographical regions and a lot of different other types of communities, you can pull together the community behind that innovation that comes out of the research that may be deployed locally, for instance. And so new startup companies that may be deployed where the people are, which may not be on the coast, the East and the West Coast, but all across the country, I think they can have a very strong ripple effect. And again, it provides that local economic opportunity with that geographic distribution as well. So just kind of like what I was mentioning a moment ago, I think this will have many broader impacts that can help local communities.
I like hearing that. That does make a lot of sense. Sorry, Chuck. So, you know, talking about the task force reports not being due until, you know, May interim and then probably November 2022 for the final. And it's very important to have that process, first of all. I know there's like a lot of urgency, but I'm really glad you're taking your time. But, you know, looking at that urgency, how do we, you know, how do we help people that are trying to get something done sooner think about how it plays into the Nair, right? Like on one hand, you don't want people waiting who want to build stuff. You're like, we'll get the Nair later. That'd be fine. And on the other, you know, how do you pre-integrate something that's, of course, uncertain to an extent?
Yeah, you know, there are a number of efforts all across the nation that have some related goals, kind of some similar goals. They're smaller. Often they're focused on a particular academic community or a particular community group. So they're not as broad reaching, but they are in the vein of this kind of the Nair concept. And so one thing that people can do to kind of get engaged more quickly is to look to see if there are existing, maybe smaller, maybe not as well as largely scoped out, but some existing kind of opportunities within their existing networks. And even if they're not, there are some all across the country. And by exploring and looking at what already exists in this vein, people can begin thinking more broadly about the future, about what could happen once access to this resource is available, what kind of innovation could be pursued, what kind of research or education opportunities or possibilities might be explored. I think, you know, even if we were to push a button and the Nair was available today, it's not going to be something that everybody's going to be able to immediately use without some planning and building up the ideas that you want to explore and doing some strategic thinking behind how you might make good use of this resource. So I think there's a lot that can be done in terms of strategic thinking about how each community around the country might want to make good use of this. And I will just say that certainly it's important to note that this task force is not going to do the implementation. It's just going to make the recommendations. And then the task force work will be completed at that point, that the task force will not actually do the implementation or even administer the Nair. So there is a next step after that. So it is a process, but I do think that there are ways that people can already begin thinking about how this resource could help them in the ways that I've described.
Makes sense. One thing I've been thinking about, actually, just for people that are also thinking about this, you know, the EDA right now has these planning grants that are coming out, right? And they also have this kind of Build Back Better community challenge. It doesn't specify this, but I'm thinking there's certainly something to be done by like engaging that planning process. You can help people use the existing support to be kind of AI ready 2 years from now, you know, like maybe get ahead of it a little bit. So I got a question for, let's see, I got a couple questions. I've got one from Shane Tews, who says, you know, I appreciate the Dr. Parker, I appreciate the magnitude of what you're working towards here to expand access. You know, what is next and what can we do to help? Do we need to help with research or is there coordination and legwork that would be most helpful? And she works at AEI, so she has think tank power.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are, you know, again, if you have a look at AI.gov at all the different kinds of pillars of activity, there's a lot to be done in so many of those other kinds of areas. I think if you dig in specifically to the infrastructure piece, and in particular, so this is cyber and data kind of infrastructure. We're also thinking about test beds. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done in the test bed space. This actually was a recommendation from the National Security Commission on AI, was to see if we could form a network of test beds around the country. So certainly we'll be thinking about how we can incorporate test beds into the mayor, but I think there's so much more that can be done there. And test beds are very important because it allows you to do that exploration, sort of that transition from the pure lab work to a more practical application. But there is that, you know, valley of death of how do you get that transition and to do that well. So test beds can help a lot. They can also help in terms of measurement and evaluation of one type of system versus a different type of system. And so there's a huge need for more infrastructure around test beds, for instance. So that's one area that I would mention in the area of AI and research infrastructure.
Joe.
Okay. No, that's very Boston. Good. Yeah, Joe Mello, go ahead.
Yeah, Joe has a question. Joe's from Congressman McInerney's office, who happens to be the co-chair of the Artificial Intelligence Caucus on the Hill. Joe.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Dr. Parker, for taking some time to present to us. If we're working with people in our district on AI workforce and economic development plans, what's the best way to plug them into the task force?
So one of the things that we're doing in our task force meetings, so we have meetings, we're having four meetings this year, we had two already, we're having four meetings next year. And in those meetings, we're having panels of external stakeholders who are providing us different kinds of perspectives on the task force. I think when it comes to the topic of education, for instance, at one point during our assessment, we'll be looking at what kind of educational tools will be needed for this task force, because we want it to be easy to use. We don't want it only to be available for PhDs who already understand how to use these kinds of resources, but we want it to be made easy. And so I keep plugging the RFI. I think, you know, the extent to which people from the education community have ideas, it's great to have them plugged in there as well. But we hope to have a panel of experts from the education community as we think about educational tools for the NAIR. And so that's another way for some folks to engage there as well. So that's just a couple of thoughts.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, Joseph, you and Svetlana need to talk to the mayor of Stockton and make sure he replies. I know he's excited.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
If anybody else wants to put their hand up, I have a quick question besides that, but I don't want to dominate since I already have. I want to defer if possible. All right. Well, so one last question for me then, since we're taking up time here. So I love hearing about test beds, and I've probably asked about this too much over the past couple of years, but I do find it like a really interesting vector between like building the infrastructure for research and having the infrastructure for development, right? And it seems to me like testing itself is going to be based more upon like massive simulation or retraining models over and over, inferencing them repeatedly, which seem like infrastructure that you could easily purpose for both sides of it, right? Like, do you think that there will be testbed systems that house data and compute that like the research itself will be based upon testing those systems to an extent. Like if you have massive language models or foundation models with this unexplored internal space. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many possibilities here. I mean, you could think of, you mentioned, you know, models. You can, and I talked about sharing data, but you could also share models that folks build up and then use those to explore a lot of different kinds of possibilities. I think, you know, testing, I just want to kind of put a plug in for standards and metrics as well, measurement tools. In many areas of AI, and it's, you know, there are a lot of different algorithms that can be used to accomplish different kinds of tasks. And often you want to know, well, which is best and when is it best? And having that ability to have some standardized approaches for measuring and evaluating is an important step for us being able to really transition these. And to, you know, when you're in a test bed, what are you testing? You know, you're testing often against some standards and metrics. And so I think that's an important area that we also need to focus on as well. And you could think, you know, digital twins are certainly a big thing now, and it's a great concept for being able to test from a real world kind of application to test in simulation in the digital world. And that you can imagine building new kinds of test beds for AI systems that leverage some of those kinds of concepts. And so I think this kind of resource, I think, will open the door to so many possibilities for helping us more rigorously build AI systems that can work in the real world. I think, you know, safety and security is another extremely important topic of trying to build AI systems that we know are robust and reliable, safe and secure. And often it's so hard to do these you can't easily prove that an AI system is by definition, you know, mathematically secure, but test beds can help you explore a lot of different scenarios for that. And it could be simulation kinds of test beds in the digital world, or it could be physical test beds. So there's a lot of opportunity here, a lot of possibilities.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's very exciting to me, which shows how deep down this rabbit hole I've gone. So we have another question here. Carol Ann Weichel, I believe, says, please expand on the fifth pillar. What about bilateral relationships, and what do you foresee as possibilities?
Yeah, so the fifth pillar, that as I described it, was international engagement. And I mentioned the Global Partnership on AI. I also mentioned the OECD. We have a formal bilateral agreement with United Kingdom in AI R&D. So last year we signed a declaration for AI R&D cooperation. And those bilaterals are extremely important. We don't have a formal agreement with India, for instance, but we did kick off the Indo-US Science and Technology Forum on AI. So there's a series of activities, and that's primarily at the federal agency level on the US side, and then similarly on the Indian side, and they're pursuing a number of AI initiatives. Through the research agencies, we have a lot of bilateral arrangements and partnerships and research in a lot of areas. And so those are a very important component to leveraging the capabilities and the knowledge and the understanding that other nations have. Maybe they have some unique kinds of expertise that can couple with the expertise that we have in the United States. So those kind of partnerships, country to country or multilateral, are all have value.
Makes a lot of sense. How are we doing on time? I don't want to go over. I think we may have the 140 cutoff. But
I think we have the 140 cutoff.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I think we're.
Okay. Dr. Parker, do you want to give us any closing thoughts?
You're directing that to me. Yes. So I will just say that I think this kind of sort of big thinking about what do we need to do for the nation as a whole to advance AI innovation is so important. It's helping us as we look at increased competition from around the world. There's a lot of a lot of reasons why it's helpful to be a first mover in this space. And it's helpful for quality of life. It's helpful for economic competitiveness. It's helpful for national security. And so there are a lot of reasons why the United States can benefit from having a leading edge AI R&D program and being able to translate this into use. Obviously, we want to use it responsibly. And so that's another line of effort that's important for us to pursue. But I think there are a lot of benefits that help the nation as a whole. It's not just about helping a researcher at some university, but it has the ripple effects that we've talked about. And so I encourage everyone, again, please give us your thoughts through the RFI. And thank you, Tim and Austin, for the opportunity to chat about this with you all.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin. Thank you, Dr. Parker. Again, thanks to everybody. We had a ton of people join. Thank you so much. And at the suggestion of Shane Dews, I put up in the chat the link to the request for information for the NAIRR. So it's there. Look for another one of these tech policy recess talks in October and then another one in November. And thanks for joining us. And thanks to the Congressional Internet Caucus and the co-chairs, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, Congressman Mike McCall, Senator Patrick Leahy, and Senator John Thune. We really appreciate it. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.